Welcome to the pre-show notes for the audio-described performance of Timeline Theater's The Lifespan of a Fact by Jeremy Carrican and David Merle and Gordon Farrell, based on the book by John DeGatta and Jim Fingal, directed by Michelle Moe. My name is Kellen Henthorne, and I'm Timeline's Audience Services Manager. This performance will be described for you by Ashley Braggs. In this pre-show notes program, you'll hear from Ashley about the set design. Then you will hear directly from the cast about the visual elements of their characters in the play, The Lifespan of a Fact. So let's get things started and hear about the set design from Ashley.
Hello, I'm Ashley Braggs. I'll be your audio describer for Lifespan of a Fact. Before we meet, I wanted to take a moment to describe the play set in more detail. Lifespan of a Fact begins at a Manhattan-based magazine company, more specifically, in the sleek office of editor-in-chief Emily Penrose. Naturally, most of the action in the office happens at and around the desk. The desk is positioned so that the person seated at the desk is facing the audience, and the objects on the desk are facing away from the audience. The surface of the desk is stark white. On the desk, at the occupant's far left, is a black telephone with a handset and a dial pad. At least one of the play's characters will use this telephone during the play. The spiraling cord between the handset and the dial pad stretches as the person on the phone stands or moves away from the phone. Next, further to the right, next to the phone, is a white mug with a gold handle. Further to the right, at the center of the desk, is a white laptop computer. When it's open, the Apple logo is visible. During the play, characters will sit in front of, type at, or stand around this computer. To the right of the computer, slightly in front, is a gold picture frame. Whatever picture the frame holds, it is not immediately visible to the audience. At one point in the play, a guest in the office comments on the photo while standing behind the desk without commenting specifically on what it is. At the far right front edge of the desk is a brown accordion folder. Under the folder are a couple of sheets of white paper. The legs of the desk are thin slats of golden brown wood. The white desk has no drawers, so anything under the desk is completely visible. This includes a partial view of the chair behind the desk. Like the surface of the desk, the chair is white. It has a low curved back, and it is set on wheels. Facing the desk, a few feet away, is another white chair. This chair has a square back and rectangular arms. Its legs have no wheels. Behind the desk is a wall made up of vertical and diagonal slats of the same golden brown color as the desk's legs. On the wall behind the desk, dozens of magazine covers, The Optimist, form neat lines. During the play, images and words are projected onto this wall. This includes more magazine covers, days of the week, and text from emails. At some point in the play, we move from Manhattan to Las Vegas. In the transition, projections of colorful neon signs flash over the paneled wall. The paneled wall splits open to reveal the Nevada home of another character, John DeGosta. An angular roof becomes visible. Above it, a titled sign lined with lights reads, "Welcome to the Fabulous Las Vegas." In the word welcome, colored lights surround each letter. The word Vegas is partially concealed by the roof. Where the Manhattan office is sleek and bright, John's home is drab and dated. The Manhattan office color scheme is white and light brown with some gold. The Las Vegas home is mostly brown on brown with faded florals and paisleys. Let's discuss the layout of John's home. The front half of the home, which is staged closest to the audience, is a living room. The back half of the home, staged furthest from the audience, is the home's entryway and kitchen. Starting with the entryway, at the very back, far left of the stage, is the home's front door. The frame is made of dark brown wood. The door has an opaque window embedded with a crisscross overlay. The window lets in light, but doesn't show clear images. The characters in the play will enter and exit John's home through this door. Moving to the audience's right, beyond the door is a narrow entryway that leads to another door I presume to be a closet, and a small open kitchen. The entryway walls are covered with wallpaper that has a print of faded orange flowers. On one wall is a framed painting of a southwestern landscape with mountains and cacti. Continuing to the right, we reach John's small kitchen. The entire kitchen is open and visible to the audience, the same way one might find in a studio apartment. The counter has dishes and small appliances common in a kitchen. For example, during a phone call, John paces in the kitchen and pours himself a cup of coffee. The counters are yellow. Above the sink is a window covered with sheer curtains. Below the sink are cabinets and drawers made of brown wood. To the right of the sink is a white kitchen range that includes a stove and an oven. Next to the kitchen is another door. Next to the door is a short set of stairs that lead to another part of the home. Between the front half and back half of the home, two stone pillars and a metal railing separate the kitchen entryway and the living room. Entering the living room requires going down one step. In the living room, the largest piece of furniture is a worn, faded couch. It's light brown with hints of faded pinks and blues. The characters will sleep on, sit on, and recline on the couch throughout the play. On the couch, there are two round, orangish-yellowish pillows, typically found at either end. A blue floral print blanket can be found on the couch. Sometimes it's neatly folded on one end, other times it's draped along the back. In front of the couch is a rectangular coffee table that's dark brown. During the play, the table goes from just a few objects on top of it, a small plant, a few sheets of paper, a couple of pens, to notebooks, a laptop, piles of papers, more pens, and even a food container. Underneath the table's surface is another shelf crowded with a messy pile of books. Under the table is a faded orange rug with a geometric print on it. To the right of the couch and table, a couple of feet away, is an armchair. It's light brown with a medium brown embroidered print. On the chair is a rectangular brown and white pillow. Directly next to the armchair is a small end table attached to a magazine rack with a few magazines tucked inside. During the play, we'll find papers, pens, and other small items placed on this small table. Moving across the room to the audience's left, on the other side of the couch, is another end table, slightly bigger. It's medium brown. On top of it is a white lamp with a matching shade. The lamp is turned on and off during the course of the play. Next to it is a box of tissues. Under the end table are several board games, including Monopoly, Pictionary, and Sorry. In addition to Emily's office and John's home, there are two other spaces represented in the play. At one point, we see one character, Jim, working alone. His workspace is set up on the left front part of the stage. Emily's office is still visible, but the spotlight on Jim and the dim light on Emily's office suggests they are further apart in the world of our story. Jim sits at a tiny table with just enough space for a laptop and a few papers. The surface of the table is flat and brown. Both the table and chair Jim uses are on wheels. At another point in the play, we find ourselves at where we presume to be Emily's home. During this time, Emily occupies a small portion of the stage just adjacent to John's home. A spotlight shines on her, but there are no set pieces or props that visualize this space. When the play begins, we hear the voice of writer John DaGosta as he reads from his most recent essay. Black and white images are projected onto the wood-paneled wall behind Emily Penrose's desk. They include a city skyline, a building facade with the word stratosphere affixed to it, a lighted sign with an image of a woman perched on top, a chicken with its head bowed. This concludes our set description. I look forward to meeting you for our audio-described play, Lifespan of Effect. Thank you.
Now for the actors, explaining the visual elements of their characters. Up first, Juliet Hart, playing Emily Penrose.
Hello, friends. I am Juliet Hart, and I am playing Emily Penrose in the Chicago premiere of The Lifespan of a Fact at Timeline Theater. I am one of the founding members of Timeline. but I haven't been on stage in about 4 years. The last show I did was Oslo at the Broadway Playhouse right before the COVID-19 pandemic. In that show, I changed costume about 17 times, but I didn't need to learn nearly as many lines as I did for this play. Emily Penrose is the name of the character who I play, and she is the editor-in-chief of The Optimist magazine. She is a mentor of sorts to young Jim Fingle, the fact-checker assigned to the John DeGatta piece that Emily is longing to publish. And Emily and John, the writer of said essay, go back a long time and have a creative relationship of many years, which is very similar to me and PJ Powers, who plays that part in the play. I am 5'6.5", not quite 5'7". My hair is a grayish blonde, and I am fair in skin tone. I like to think of Emily as moving around kind of like a crane, a bird. That's what I use in my mind when I move across the stage. And I really enjoy the opportunity of inhabiting my office space with power. And I will say it's especially thrilling to be doing this play in our beloved old home on Wellington Avenue. So I try and feel like I am at home and empowered in my space. I have a beautiful costume or costumes in this show. I love my clothes. I am in sort of blush and beige tones with warm gold accents for the opening scenes in New York in my office. I wear high-heeled pumps and really move through the space with the power of a woman at the top of her game. Later on in the scenes in Las Vegas, Emily has traveled across country and I'm in much more casual clothing, flats, navy blue, casual pants, and a sweater. And in the final scene on Monday morning, as we are driving towards finishing up our work on the piece for deadline, I have my hair in a messy bun and have taken off my sweater. So Emily sort of deconstructs as her visions for this piece begin to flail a bit as the story progresses. I have some wonderful jewelry in the play, including some lovely necklaces. And sometimes I can hear the buttons on my jacket clanging against the typewriter keys as Emily works hard to keep her magazine upright and heading towards a publication deadline. I really love the command that I'm able to take with all of my lines. And I'll just give you sort of an opener of Emily's first email, which is, "Hey everyone, in light of recent events, we're bumping congressional spouses and going with the John DeGatta piece originally slated for February. Thank you so much for listening with us today. I hope that I see you at some point during the run of this show, and I hope that you enjoy this performance."
And next, we'll hear from Alex Benito Rodriguez playing Jim Fingle.
Hi there. My name is Alex Benito Rodriguez, and I play Jim Fingle in the Chicago premiere of The Lifespan of a Fact at Timeline Theater. You may have caught me previously in Bonicelli in the Fire at First Floor Theater, and I also understudied for Remy Bumpo's production of Anna in the Tropics. I am so very thrilled to be making my Timeline Theater debut in this show. My character's name is Jim Fingle, a newly graduate of Harvard in his mid-20s, who is interning for a major magazine in New York City. I've been asked by my editor-in-chief, Emily Penrose, to fact-check a new article, or essay, depending on who you're asking, written by John DeGatta. And it is a job that I take very seriously, to the annoyance of Emily and John. I am approximately 5'10", with light olive skin tone, and dark brown hair that sometimes looks more black than brown, depending on the lighting. I have no facial hair in this show. Jim's postures and movements change depending on how animated or stressed he may be related to the work that he is doing on this essay. And at times he moves around the stage almost like a puppy who needs to burn energy, and other times stands still and clear-eyed with a fully straight spine when he's trying to make his arguments. Jim starts the show looking very polished. I wear a button-up shirt and tie with a blue sweater over it. I have khaki pants and also some boat shoes. At the top of the show, I am wearing a leather messenger bag on my shoulder, which has all of my important notes. As the play progresses, Jim slowly removes his layers and becomes more casual by the end of the show. By the end of the scene, by the end of the show, I am wearing a red polo and a soft green hoodie. One of Jim's most crucial props is a gray notebook that I carry with me in reference in every scene. Jim has a backpack filled with many other notebooks, but this small, light-worn gray notebook is his most prized and most important object. Vocally, Jim's voice is a little higher than mine to help highlight his youth and what some may call naivete and eagerness. One of my lines at the top of the show is, "I was a joint concentrator in computer science and journalism. I wrote a few stories and some editorials for the Crimson, Harvard, and whatever jobs I got after college were just marking time until I got here, where I'm really happy." I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope you really enjoy the show. Have a great one.
Finally, PJ Powers playing John DeGatta.
Hey there. My name is PJ Powers, and I'm playing the role of John DeGatta in the Chicago premiere of The Lifespan of a Fact here at Timeline Theater. If you have been to Timeline before, you might also know me from my day job, which is as Timeline's artistic director and one of the company's co-founders. With this production of Lifespan of a Fact, I am very excited to be stepping out from mostly being behind the scenes for the last decade or so and to be returning to the Timeline stage. The last couple shows that I appeared in were that Hopi Changey thing 8 years ago, which was one part of the two Apple family plays that we produced in Rotating Rep. And before that, it was our production of The Front Page way back in 2011. So it is really great to be back on our stage here on Wellington Avenue and to be performing alongside my fellow Timeline co-founder, Juliet Hart, with whom I had the honor of appearing in our first show in this space, the play Gaslight, back in 1999. Plus, Juliet and I have the privilege of working with the terrific actor Alex Rodriguez, who is making his Timeline debut in this show. For The Lifespan of a Fact, I am playing the character of John DeGatta. In the script, it says that he can be anywhere in the range of age 40 to 60, and I guess I hit the sweet spot since I am 50. The character of John DeGatta is based on a real guy with the same name, who is a noted essayist and now also a professor of writing. Inspired by a true story, the play is about an essay that John wrote about the city of Las Vegas and a tragic suicide of a teenager that took place there. Following that true story, the magazine that was going to publish John's essay hired an intern to fact-check the piece, and that intern, named Jim Fingle, took issue with quite a lot, like hundreds of points in John's essay. And that kicked off a lengthy debate between John and Jim, which they ultimately turned into a book that's also called The Lifespan of a Fact. In the play, caught in between John and Jim, trying to be an arbiter, is the third character, Emily Penrose, who is the editor of the magazine, who has worked with John many times before and who knows that John takes some creative liberties in his writing. My character is 5 feet 9 inches tall, Caucasian, with dark hair that has streaks of gray, and the hair is often quite tousled during the play, plus a scruffy beard that is maybe more salt than pepper in color. He wears glasses occasionally during the play, just readers when he is reading from any papers on stage. During the play, John ranges from being, I'd say, somewhat professorial in his approach to Jim, to becoming incredibly agitated and at times downright furious or aggressive about having to explain the creative choices he's made in his writing. So physically, this means that John ranges from being somewhat still and pensive to becoming far more animated in his movements. John basically has two costumes in the play. We first see him on the phone in what looks like it might be his work attire, teaching at UNLV in Las Vegas. He's wearing jeans, an untucked plaid shirt with a sport coat over it, and laced-up brown shoes. Then we see him at home, dressed a bit more casually, with an untucked short-sleeve shirt, jeans, and more casual slip-on shoes. And as the play goes on, the short-sleeve shirt gets unbuttoned to reveal a gray t-shirt underneath. John does not wear any wedding ring or other jewelry or accessories. And in his home, we often see him holding a coffee mug or reading and grading papers for his class. The first time that John appears on stage, he is on his cell phone. He's calling Jim in response to an email that came from Jim questioning some of the facts in John's essay. So immediately, somewhat irritated that some intern is questioning his work, John's opening lines are, "Is this Jim Fingal?" And after Jim confirms that, John says, "Listen, Jim Fingal, you're not going to fix anything. Nothing's broken." From there, more drama ensues, a lot of debate, and also quite a lot of comedy mixed in as part of John and Jim's banter, as well as Emily's thankless task of trying to tame these two very, very opinionated men. Thank you for listening to this overview of my character, John DeGatta, and thanks for coming out to experience a show at Timeline. I am so glad that you're here, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Thanks for listening to the pre-show notes for the audio-described performance of The Lifespan of a Fact. We hope you enjoy the show and your time at Timeline.